Hello, this is Deborah Anderson, the Black Woman Animator, coming to you with another video. And in this video, I have Jermaine Barnes. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Jermaine Barnes. I live in Miami, currently from Chicago, and I am a designer.
All right. So you are from Chicago. How was it growing up?
I had a pretty chill childhood. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a two-parent household. I'm the youngest of quite a few siblings, so always in a nice, tight-knit family. Mm-hmm. I'm from the west side of Chicago, so that has its own connotations and its own reputation, some of which are true, some of which are not true. But all in all, I think it was an awesome place to grow up and be a kid because it taught me a lot.
What are some of your best childhood memories?
I think the best childhood memories that I have are ones where we had like large family events. So whether that be like a cookout or a birthday party or something, our house was always the house that everybody came over, all the cousins and the aunts and the uncles. So a lot of my fondest memories are tied basically to my family. And us celebrating some sort of event together, always positive.
Yeah. What is your cultural makeup? That's not to say what's your ethnicity, but what is the culture of where you grew up and the uniqueness of where you're from?
I guess the best way I can put it is I am a direct result of the Great Migration. So culturally, that's where I provide. That's what I know. Mm-hmm. My parents' families being from the South, meaning that you grow up a certain way, you eat a certain food, you talk a certain way. And so a lot of people think I'm from the South when I talk. Mm-hmm. I have a bit of an accent until I say I'm from Chicago and they seem confused. But if you understand the Great Migration, then you understand that many people from Chicago, their families directly from the South. So you might be from Mississippi, you might be from Arkansas, but it's all the same.
Yeah, I've heard that. About accents from Chicago and stuff like that. What's crazy is I know your paternal family's from Mississippi and your maternal family's from Arkansas. On my mom's side, my grandfather's from Mississippi and my grandma's from Arkansas. So,
that's how it works. It's not that many places that Black people were from, so they end up there.
Yeah. What was your journey in art during your childhood?
I went to a pretty fancy elementary school. It was a public school, but it was still kind of fancy. And so we had fine arts classes every day of the week. So I was fortunate enough to have that as a kid that would teach me sort of art skills. Mm-hmm. And then my first job at 14 was painting murals for the local library. And then in high school, I went to a pretty fancy public high school too. So that high school had a lot of arts programming. So like, I took fine arts classes, I took photography classes and things. So all the stuff that sort of trained me and prepared me for my current career were all things I've been doing since I was an adolescent. Definitely one of the fortunate few in my neighborhood that went to a school that had these types of resources. Because unfortunately, Chicago public schools are not that good.
Yeah. Did you always want to be an architect, or what are the multiple things that you wanted to be as a kid?
As far back as maybe like kindergarten, I've only ever wanted to be an architect. Although also at that time, I had extreme adoration for the NBA. So the goal was to be in the NBA and to be an architect, not one or the other. It was to be concurrent.
Right.
Which I would always say, like as a kid, that when I finished basketball games, I'd hop on my private jet and go to my business meetings.
Right.
One of those two things came to fruition. So. Fortunately, in that regard, that's what happened. But I've always ever wanted to be an architect and nothing else. My parents wanted me to do other things, and I did it to sort of pacify them so they would leave me alone. But I always know it's going to be an architect in the back of my mind.
So saying that, were your parents not supportive of you wanting to be an architect, or what was that?
No, I just think most people don't know what architects do. Whenever you say you're an architect, they say, oh, you can build my house. Like, architects don't actually build houses. We just design them. Contractors build houses. So, yeah, it's like if you tell somebody that you repair computers or something, and they say, oh, so you can come in here and you can build me one from scratch. It's like, perhaps, but that's not what I do. Like, that's not
right
purpose. So with most people of color, my parents want me to be a doctor or a lawyer.
So, that's pretty.
Yeah, it's the same every single time because that's like the most attainable thing they can think of that with stability. But I don't think they realize how rigorous those two fields are and how much time it takes. I think you just get glamorized on TV and think, oh, you can be a doctor or lawyer. Like this, that takes a lot of time and resources and privilege to get to those careers. So I did all of the pre-law stuff I was supposed to do so they can get off my back. But the entire time, I know I'm going to be an architect.
Yeah, that's when I would go speak to kids in the school. My idea was like, let me teach them all the things they could be between a football player and a basketball player and a doctor and a lawyer. Like, there's so much in between.
Absolutely, man. You tell somebody they can be an actuarial scientist and make six figures, they'll look at you like you're speaking a foreign language.
Right.
It's like, bro, it's literally just data and spreadsheets. And you go to work 9 to 5 and come home and you make six figures, which is, you do that for the rest of your life, which is a longer and more efficient earning potential than playing professional sports.
Right. Yeah. And then the point of my platform is like, you don't have a neighbor that's in animation. So even though I'm professionally, I'm a 3D modeler, I go by Black Woman Animator because that's what people know what that is. Yeah. So I feel like as Black Americans, some of us have this like longing for identity that was stripped from us, which causes us not to realize the depth of what we created in our own pockets of the country and collectively. You still have the willingness to explore other cultures, but what makes you so grounded in who you are and where you come from and your willingness to create projects from this culture?
To be totally honest with you, it's because it's easier to do work that you're familiar with and you're sort of an expert on than trying to learn something new. And so with architecture and design, for a while, it was going through a couple of different phases where people were interested in to do sort of like amorphous shapes or then parametricism with computation embedded, all this kind of stuff that I was just trying to ride the wave. I was like, all right, you know, it's just like music, right? Like if everything right now is like trap, then you try to make yourself a trap hit, even if it's not what you're good at, right? Like maybe you feel that's just soulful rap and you're going against the grain because that's what's popular and you feel like the quickest way to make an imprint and to get on and then eventually get back to the soulful stuff is to do the trap stuff.
Yeah.
So I thought the best way to get on quicker was to adopt the parametric computation stuff. And so I would apply to competitions and stuff and not even get like a finalist for any of the things. And I was like, man, I'm writing to all these things. I barely know what this stuff is about. Like I'm a smart guy. So I can read up and understand it at like an elementary level, but like I'm not proficient in any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So one year I just said, you know what? I'm about to just write about what I know. And either I get this money or I don't get this money. And so I wrote about the porch, what it means to hang out on porches, which is big in Chicago. Because again, that great migration, ritual migration stuff. So I did that, won, and got money for it. And I was like, yo, you telling me I can get money for just the regular mundane shit we do on a regular basis? And so I just started like really leaning into it into like, all right, what is the other stuff that I really know front and back that I can use to get sort of create work rooted in identity, but also not going as far as to make it so it could be commodified. That's always a fear. But that's honestly where it came from. It's just like, I'm going to write about what I know.
Yeah.
So I know the soulful stuff. So that's what I leaned into. Unfortunately, it's been hidden.
And that's kind of what you find in so many industries is like in my industry, say somebody's like a character designer or a prop designer or something like that. And they're like, oh, maybe if I do butterflies, then I can get on. Like, if you don't like creating butterflies, do not put that in your portfolio. Like, just like the people who say with Excel, if you don't like Excel, don't tell nobody you can do Excel.
Yep, because then they expect you to know it. They expect you, they expect you to do it. But even then, I know for architecture and design, if you trying to go for these competitions and you don't really know it, then when you write it, the experts who's reading these submissions, they know the stuff. Like they have people on the panel that can say, this person don't know what the hell they talking about. They just saying words. And so you're like, you already done did yourself in because you weren't being authentic.
Right.
And so the other thing I had to learn how to do is I had to like pay my dues in the way of sitting on panels, reviewing the applications so that I can learn tricks of the trade.
Yeah.
So I did that for a couple years, like took myself out of the running to be awarded anything so I can sit on juries and adjudication panels And then through that process, I was like, oh, so this is what they're looking for. Oh, yeah. This is the way to put the best portfolio together. Oh, this kind of stuff that nobody teaches you otherwise.
Right.
And then a lot of wins start coming out that.
That's what's up. Do you have any good stories of people coming up to you, telling you the impact of seeing you be your authentic self?
Yeah. And I'll tell you, it never gets weird. Like it never stops getting weird. mainly because like, I only know how to be myself. Like I struggle to not be me. Like I know that sounds weird to say out loud, but it's the truth. Like
right.
Some people find it very easy to sort of adopt another avatar.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I'm like, do you know how much effort it takes for me to do that? And like, do I really want to like if I want to spend my time doing that? That's not even the same as code switching, right? Code switching.
Right, right.
Maybe I don't curse as much or maybe I don't talk as sort of fluid as I do when I'm just having regular conversations, right?
Right.
In that way. But I just mean like adopting a brand new personality. That shit just takes way too much effort for me. Like I am not a super bubbly and happy person. Like that's not my personality. So I'm not about to do all the effort to do that. Like I'm mad laid back. Like that's just that's just my thing.
Right.
So whenever people will meet me and they'd be like, yo, I was so inspired by your talk because it told me I can just be myself. And I'm just in there like, you didn't know that before?
Right.
Like, you didn't realize you could just be you, bro? Wow. It never stops being weird, but it happens more than you can think. But I guess because like we're in a field that's skews predominantly white,
mm-hmm.
so when you have people who are people of color or a marginalized community, a lot of times they feel the need to assimilate, mm-hmm. and through that assimilation they begin to lose their own identity or lose their cultural values.
Yeah.
And so when they meet somebody who refuses to relinquish that,
mm-hmm.
then for them it's like, wow, I didn't know that was possible. And so for me, I'm never going to relinquish it because, and I always say this jokingly to my friends, and well, not to my friends, I say this jokingly to other architects, but my friends know the reference because my friends know black movies. I'd be like, if this shit don't work out, the hood still gonna love me. It's like they're straight from Paid in Full. Right. Man, Mitch say, you know, it's like regardless, the hood still gonna love me. So that's how I just, and people in the rooms don't know what the hell I be talking about when I say.
Right.
But it's the honest truth. Like, they don't know what half these awards mean, they don't know what half this stuff.
Right.
Like means professionally, they just see they homie from back home and be like, yo, he's doing great. And they support me, but they don't understand the context.
I was wondering if he was going to be like, you ain't got a lot of kick it, Craig.
not at all, man. They don't know none of this stuff, man. I'd be like, yeah, I just won this award. And my cousin would be like, all right, cool, but we better play spades. You want to play and all? I'm like, yeah, man. Or my other homies at home, I'd be like, they hit me up and say, yo, I saw you on Instagram. What's that thing you want? I'll explain it. And they'd be like, no, we don't know what the hell that means, but good.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
So what is the importance of carrying the torch of storytelling that our ancestors have done for centuries in your desired field? And what is the uniqueness in your field of how you're doing it?
To be totally honest with you, man, just being black hard as hell. Like that is some difficult shit. Like on a daily basis, just the amount of emotional labor you got to deal with, physical labor, mental labor is just so much.
Yeah.
And so I always like try to ground myself in reality of my ancestors had it way worse than I have it.
Mm-hmm.
Way worse. Obviously, there's still a bunch of structural inequities that we do on a regular basis. Racism is gone nowhere.
Right.
But like, I'm not being lynched. I'm not having to like sneak through the dead of night and sundown towns, which still exist, but I ain't got to like worry about the kind of cop on a plane, get my ass over.
I opt out.
Yeah, right. Like I ain't got to go do those things. And so I think in that regard, like I always tell myself, bro, you don't have it that hard.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we still have it hard, but like, I ain't got it that hard. Like on the suffering Olympics, like I'm a distant 50th. Whereas they was like first and second place. So in that regard, I try to remind myself that the work I'm doing is important and it's necessary. And if it means that I lose a little bit of sleep and instead of getting 8 hours, I get six, then it is what it is. Because ultimately, it's something that continues a legacy of people who sacrifice much more than I've ever had to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to that, what it ends up sort of manifesting as is all of the young black students that come up to me and say they want to talk to me, or students who don't even go to my school. I get so many emails.
Yeah.
And young black designers who just like, yo, can I just get 30 minutes of your time? And I'm just like, God damn, I ain't got 30 minutes. But at the same time, I'm like, yo, I was that kid. Like I was the one that wrote I wrote this professor at University of Michigan why I did not go to school. Was like, hey, you got time when I talk to you? And he said, yeah. So I've always told myself I can't be the one to say no because somebody said yeah to me.
Yeah.
And so in that regard, it's like being able to have this role is so pivotal, but it's so laborious. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so laborious.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to being able to be a keeper of stories, like, I take that from my grandmother, who was like our family griot.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to keep using sort of like West African terms. And so I try to use architectural objects to be griots, right? So like, how can a chair tell a story?
Yeah.
How can a table tell a story? How can a building tell a story? It's a lot easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've done it effectively in a few ways. I think I've done it ineffectively in other ways. But ultimately, it's more of a ethnographic approach,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to a design approach, which in our field, people tend to be confused about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're a designer. Like, why do you care so much about people? I'm like, then who the hell are we doing it for?
If right. I
care about people. Like, y'all hear how dumb y'all sound? Like, it just sounds so stupid to me. So, excuse my bluntness. Like, I just be sitting there like, y'all sound so stupid. Like, you realize what you're saying right now?
It's the privilege, though, to not think about it.
Yeah. So for me, all the work I do is always rooted in ethnography first, right? So it's more of a anthropological approach to architecture as opposed to a spatial approach to architecture.
Yeah.
Which always freaks people out when I say that. I'm like, mm-hmm, I don't care about buildings. I don't. It's a goddamn building. It's an inanimate object. I do not care. I care about the people that's in the space and the rituals that happen within the space. That's the stuff that gives me life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember, you know, I went to Rochester Institute of Technology in upstate New York, and like, I would seek out, like, even from the beginning, because when we had our opening ceremony freshman year, there was like a professor, Dr. Jenkins, a Black man, very prolific, great speaker. And I reached out to him. Like, I don't even think I comprehended how many Black people were not professors in my major. I just like, oh, that's a dynamic Black man. Let me introduce myself to him. I introduced myself to another person, my friend Thaddeus, who was like, he was an engineering technology professor, and like, I was just tapped into all these people who are not animation professors, but I was like, but they're Black and, you know, they speak to me. So I would go visit people all across campus all the time just to like vibe and just talk about stuff. So you had a professor that said like race and architecture had nothing to do with each other and were completely independent, and you proceeded to change your thesis to prove him wrong, mm-hmm, for the rest of the semester. For me, kind of tangentially, like in college, our Black Student Union was called the Black Awareness Coordinating Committee. And we would have these events where we were trying to talk about race, but the white people wouldn't come. Mm-hmm. So my junior and senior year, I made every project about race that I could because I wanted to know what they thought. And they thought some dumb things, but it was like, okay, y'all got to come to class. Y'all got to participate. So y'all have to like respond.
Sure.
I remember, being in one class and the guy was like, oh, you know, I was covering the Vogue cover of LeBron James and Giselle where it imitated the
King Kong.
Yeah, the King Kong. And he was like, oh, maybe they called him a monkey in a positive way. And I'm just like, what? So what have you learned and what have you gained from bucking the system?
If I'm being honest with you, I don't think I've learned anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because it's stuff that we all knew already. Like, mm-hmm, I would say they've learned stuff. It's
right.
Like when the Floyd protests happened, everybody was like, oh my God, y'all weren't lying. It's like, duh, we've been telling y'all that police brutality was a thing. Like, we've been telling y'all that it didn't matter if you comply. We've been telling y'all that it don't matter if you got your hands up or your hands down or you lay on the ground, they'll still find a way to beat the hell out of you.
Yeah.
It just finally got recorded and you idiots finally believe us, but we told y'all.
Right.
So when it comes to this work I'm doing, I'm like, I haven't learned anything. Like, this is all stuff that I know about. Like, I know how architecture and race are inextricably linked.
Right.
These idiots didn't. Like, I knew already.
Right.
So when they said it, I was like, what? Like, what are you talking about, bro? So in that regard, I didn't learn anything.
Yeah. You learning them some.
Yeah. It's like, I ain't learned nothing. What did I teach? I've taught a bunch of students how linked that these issues are, that a building is not unbiased. Like a lot of times people peddle this idea that objects are just inanimate and cannot produce any type of injustice, but the people that design it are agents of that. So if you design something in such a way that it precludes a certain group of people, then that building is no longer a neutral, inanimate object. It's something that clearly has agency. So if you know the typical Black family is six people, but you design a living unit for a white nuclear family, then you're clearly prescribing a certain prejudice. Like you're saying, I don't need y'all in this type of building. I don't know what y'all supposed to do. You got to live a different type of way. And so in that regard, people got to understand that, this bedroom can be racist as hell because it was designed by somebody racist. And in that way, people are really morons because they didn't realize that. But I think now they do. So I don't call my students morons because they're ignorant. They don't know anything yet. So in that regard, they're learning. But the older people, they just stupid.
That's like, was it during the pandemic or right before the pandemic where they in Texas, the real estate board was like, oh, we're going to change the name of master bedroom. It's like, but redlining though.
It's just, it's like, it's performative BS. It's like, come on, bro. Like, what are we talking about here, man? Like, what, y'all really don't get it. Well, they really do, but they don't care. But they don't care. They don't care.
Like, they solving the problems in every way. We're not asking them to solve the problems. And then, like, I was scoping out some, like, coffee shops and libraries to see, you know, where I could, like, have, like, you know, the tables or whatever. And I've discovered in L.A., like, they've taken a lot of seating out because of the homeless population. And then when you think about the benches they create with the little spikes on it so that...
Hostile architecture. All that stuff is by design. And I mean, the thing that annoys me is everybody said, like, we have enough housing units to house every single homeless person in America. Why don't we just put them in their own place? And it's like, do you know how many other structural issues are tangent to housing? Giving them housing will keep them safe from inclement weather. It will not provide them jobs. It will not provide them a place away from their mental health or substance abuse or all of the other things, or domestic violence, because many people that are homeless are actually just escaping domestic relationships and stuff, and they're not technically homeless in the way that we think of them being technically homeless, like being out on the street. They might just live in a car or live hotel to hotel, which by all definition you're still homeless. But there's so many facts that go into it. Like, give them somewhere to live, that's important, but also what are the other resources you're going to provide as well,
right? White people typically concentrate on racism from conservatives or overt racism. What racism do you see or experience from people who identify as progressives or liberals?
I actually don't know that many progressives that are white, if I'm being, totally honest with you.
Do they think they're progressive?
Nah, I think a lot of the white people I know call themselves liberal. I don't know that many white people that call themselves progressive. I would say progressive this is probably more recent, so you tend to find people who are more millennials or Gen Z that identify as progressive. And to be totally honest with you, I'm not around enough white people to like know what I'm just being honest. I'm not like I'm around some, but I'm not around enough to know like a lot. Like, I don't know. The ones I do know call themselves liberal, call themselves liberal or left leaning. I know a lot of progressive people of color, like a lot of friends that are Black that call themselves progressive, and I don't think they realize they're not progressive either. They also liberal. Like, progressiveness requires a sort of total dismantling of consistent capitalistic systems that many of them are not willing to relinquish. A lot of them are like, I like my job. I went to school for this degree. I'm about to take this six-figure salary. And bro, you're not progressive. They got at work. Just acknowledge you liberal and move on with it. So how many do I know? Not many. Not many. What was the rest of the question? I can tell you the funny part of the effort.
What racism do you experience from people who identify as liberal?
Yeah, so, okay, this is going to sound weird, but it's the truth. I personally, Jermaine Barnes, rarely experience racism, whether that's macro or micro, like rarely. There might be an instance where somebody might clutch their purse or some shit like that happens, but they ain't, even that's not even that often, because I ain't no elevators that much. That thing even happen. I'm just being honest with you. Like, it's just stuff doesn't happen to me very often.
Yeah.
And I think it doesn't happen to me very often because there's a certain approachability that I have that many others don't have, which is I have to acknowledge that, right?
Yeah.
So one, I am of a lighter complexion, so less fear inducing. I am not tall at all. I'm a short guy. So again, approachable, because it's not the big sort of hulking black man everybody sees in their nightmares.
Yeah.
I have short hair, right? Like, I'm a clean, relatively clean cut person. So in that regard, these are all things that work in my favor. Not things that I do to make other people feel comfortable. It's just me and my identity.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I grew up in the household, my mom would always say, a man looks good with a clean haircut. So like, I've always had my haircut, like, it is what it is.
Yeah.
She doesn't like earrings, but I got those. She don't like tattoos, I got those too. Yeah. So like, those are all things that like I have. And then and this is before I even open my mouth to speak. This is just purely off appearance. And then I don't like baggy clothes. And I don't like baggy clothes because you can't be short and have baggy clothes on. You look like, you look weird, like, in that regard. Like, you look like a cartoon character. Like, know your body type, bro. Like, I know my body type. Like, I wear clothes that fit.
Right.
But I look better, like, in that regard, right? And you can call that bang, whatever you want, but it is what it is. Like, I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
So in that regard, these are all things that make me more approachable to whites so that these types of things don't happen. Now, I do get patronized a lot. And when I say patronized, like, oh my God, you're so accomplished. Oh my God, you speak so well.
Right.
Oh my God, you're so intelligent. Where'd you go to school? Oh my God, you're so accomplished for being so young. Like, in that regard, a lot of patronizing.
Yeah.
That ain't the same as racism. It's just, it isn't like that. I would be belittling those who actually deal with racism to equate somebody telling me that I speak well with somebody that's being unlawfully arrested or something like that because of their skin color. So in that regard, these ain't things that I experience on a regular basis, but I do see them enact a lot of implicit biases on other people of color. Like, that happens all the time. Like, in my field, specifically as a professor, happens all the time when people have issues with certain students or have certain behavioral expectations of students they don't have of others. Like, in that regard, I see those types of things a lot.
Yeah.
And I do my best to nip it in the bud because it's like, you wouldn't say it to one of them white kids. So why are you worried about the black kid that's doing it?
Right.
Like, that white kid come late every single day. Why are you mad at Kayvon?
Right.
Like, treat them both the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that way, I see that a lot.
Yeah.
I see that a lot.
Yeah. When I was in New Orleans, I worked with a group that worked with race and education, and they were like, pretty much any in school, anything that is just numbers based, like attendance and all that stuff, you know, black kids were the infractors less. But if it was subjective and was dependent on the teacher determining whether they got in trouble, black kids got in trouble more.
Yeah. And implicit biases.
Yeah. So, and then they did a study where they had, like, they took account of where the teacher's eyes were going, and their eyes just concentrated on the black students more. Not that the white kids weren't doing anything bad. Mm-hmm. They just didn't notice. Kind of like when we're in a store and they follow us. And so the white girl can just steal the whole store while they're following us. So.
Yep. These are all real things, but this is why I say, like, this is stuff that I fortunately don't have to deal with. Cause like, nowadays, one, I don't shop that much as it is, but, but two, whenever I go places, like, these are not issues I fortunately have to deal with. I come in and red carpet, but don't ask me why.
In this question, I want to talk you to talk more about your creation of the ARC Times, but I will say, in the ARC Times, you would interview yourself and ask questions you would have liked to be asked. And when I was in college, I did have to come up with ways to be critiqued in class because I was one of two black people in my major my freshman year. And so, you know, my white peers would have everything to say for the person before me, after me. But when I get up there, it's like crickets. And so I'm like, how do I become better if y'all won't? I feel like they thought I was going to cuss them out, or I don't know. But it was just like, I can take constructive criticism. So I had to develop, like, ways to ask questions so that either my professor or my peers would answer them so that I can become better. So can you talk about the creation of the ARC Times?
Okay. So the professor who made the comment about race and architecture not being linked is the reason why the ARC Times existed. So a bit of a backstory. Thesis prep is the semester before your final semester in architecture school. And in thesis prep, you're supposed to figure out something that you want to critique within architecture and design, and then propose something new to contribute back to the profession or to the pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, I was like, yo, I'm from Chicago. Kanye not crazy yet. Lupe Fiasco from around the block from where I'm mm-hmm. from. Mm-hmm. I'm about to fuse architecture, hip hop, and my love for sneakers as a kid from Chicago and Air Jordans. And I'm about to just do a fly ass installation and stuff for my project, because eventually I want to work for Nike and I want to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so when you went thesis prep, they make you read a lot of books. You have to write papers, and eventually you got to come up with this booklet that sort of tells what you're going to do in the following semester and what you're going to design. And ultimately, yeah. because we're in the School of Architecture, it has to be architectural.
Yeah.
So my professor is like, maybe you can look up what it means for Black architecture. What does it mean for music and architecture, et cetera. And so he sends me out to go look up some stuff. And so I'm finding references and rap songs that people talk about the project. So I'm writing down like Jay-Z, that's why they call it a project, et cetera, this type of stuff. And through all of that, I'm writing it down. And so I started talking about how race and architecture are linked, because there is no thing as Black architecture at that time. Instead, we just take shitty architecture and prescribe it to Black people. So we say affordable housing, or we say mm-hmm. housing projects, and we call that Black. But it's like, that's just because we live in poor resources, because that's what y'all give us. That's like, that's not Black architecture. We ain't designed the crap.
Yeah.
So in that process, we got to do presentation. So I do the presentation and I put the stuff on the wall, and I'm in front of my professor and a couple of his peers, because that's how it works when you're in design. Mm-hmm. You basically do all this work. You put your work on the wall just to be humiliated in front of your classmates. You might get lucky and only get humiliated a little bit, but oftentimes right. it's just to be like perpetually flagged.
Yeah.
Flogged, like in public.
Mm-hmm.
And the man says to me, I don't know what you're doing all this for. Race and architecture have nothing to do with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Architecture is a completely neutral thing. It's an inanimate object. How can a building be racist? To which I say, you're wrong. These things are absolutely linked together. Like mm-hmm. there's a reason why you take the exact same building, put Black people as low income, put white people as luxury housing. What's mm-hmm. changed? Literally the only thing that's changed is the race of the person inside. The building ain't changed. The appliances ain't changed.
Mm-hmm.
The materials ain't changed. It's just who lives there. That's racial.
Yeah.
He's like, no, I think you're wrong. You know, we have an entire history of architecture that would agree with me and not you, to which I'm like, yeah, because it's all white people that wrote it. Like, of course they're going to agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, you know what? I'm going to change my thesis. And so from that point forward, I was like, I'm just going to prove to you that race and architecture are linked, just to piss you off every single week. Because we met every Thursday. I'm like, I'm about to just piss you off every week.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing that. I get into the next semester, which is the design semester.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's no longer hip hop or whatever. It's me showing how if you put housing, low income housing in a super rich neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
the rich people who say they want to help ain't going to want to help.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where all the best resources are and where people will do the best. So I started doing the project and I go to my first review. Again, this is a design review. And I have a professor who says, this project's racist.
Mm-hmm.
And I say back to her verbatim, you don't know what that word means. And she's like, what do you mean? I don't know what it means. I'm like, I'm Black. I legally cannot be racist.
Mm-hmm.
So it clearly cannot be a racist project. I have no institutional power to inflict any harm on any cultural demographic or ethnicity in this country.
Mm-hmm.
The predominant race here is white people. I cannot be racist. I was like, I can be prejudiced. I can be a bigot. I can be a misogynist. I cannot be racist. Can't do it. Not possible.
Mm-hmm.
If by some chance all the Black people woke up and had control of law, intelligence, etc., then I could. If we were mm-hmm. in Africa, I absolutely could. But we are in Los Angeles, California. I can't be racist. Sorry. Learn mm-hmm. definition of words before you use them. She was mad, disrespected. She was like, you can't talk to me that way. This is humiliating. You are so confrontational, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, you just saying words that ain't right. So what mm-hmm. you want me to do?
Mm-hmm.
So keep moving on with the project. And like every single review, I get another contact like that. It'd be like, not in my backyard. You're not building this low income thing. If I live in this neighborhood and I pay all this money, because I pick like the richest suburb.
Yeah.
In LA to do the project on purpose. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who like, I want to help people. The moment I put a housing development in their crib, I don't want this in my neighborhood, not in my backyard. Mm-hmm. So one day, I'm like, yo, I should write this stuff down. And so I was like, no, I'm going to make a fake newspaper. Mm-hmm. So I would get to the studio in the morning at 9 o'clock. Mm-hmm. I only had one class that final semester, and it was thesis. So I get there at 9 a.m. and I would work until 9 a.m. So 12-hour shifts, basically. Mm-hmm. Monday through Sunday. I work every single day, 9 and 9. Mm-hmm. But at 9:30, I would start writing these fake articles in the fake newspaper.
Right.
So from 9:30 until 12, I was a reporter.
Right.
And so I would use the words that the people would say during my reviews as like the titles of the column. So not in my backyard, as racist. All the stuff professors would say to me, excuse me, I would do it in the paper. Going back and get these things, these thoughts out. And the one day I said, man, why can't I just have a fucking review? Well, we're talking about the project. Why it always got to go back to these white people being offended and they want tears. So I was like, what would I actually ask myself if I really was on this thing? And so I literally just wrote an interview with myself, like the stuff I would rather be asked.
Right.
Instead of being told that this project's racist.
Right.
So that's sort of where it came from. And at my final review, I found a plotter, a guy who had he had this big 36-inch plotter that would print on newsprint. And I literally printed out the newspapers, and then at my final review, I gave the newspapers to the jurors in the crowd, like here, like you go to newspapers. I'm doing my presentation, and the two people that said not in my backyard and this project's racist were at the presentation, and the one that said it was racist cried, stood up and was like, "Oh my God, I've learned so much from you. I didn't realize my own ignorance." Blah 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 blah. And I'm just like,
"Told you, I tried to told you." Man.
So yeah. That really happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A black neighborhood and a white neighborhood could be the exact same. And the white neighborhood is worth more. Mm-hmm. And then that's how I tell poor white people about the privilege, because, you know, they always connect privilege to money. And it's like, you can literally move. You could be the nicest white person and move into a black neighborhood, and now the property value is more. Like, that's still racism, even if you didn't enact it yourself. So. Yeah. What can you say goes into architecture, the architecture of different cities? So I'm from Detroit, went to school in Rochester, New York, lived in New Orleans, lived in South Korea. I remember when I came to live in Los Angeles thinking it looked like different than any place that I lived. When I lived in New Orleans, I remember one of my exes calling the houses that Brad Pitt built after Hurricane Katrina like the alien houses because they didn't fit the aesthetic of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. But now that I live in LA, I can see how they fit the aesthetic of LA. And then one time I was watching a video of a singer I follow on Instagram who's also from Detroit and lives in LA. But on his live video, I could immediately tell that he was in the deep by the house he was sitting in front of. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to Dubai, I took maybe 10 pictures of me for proof of life for my family. But I took over 400 pictures of the architecture because, you know, I still love architecture. And I like the idea of using the pictures as reference or inspiration for future projects. So again, what can you say goes into the architecture of different cities?
To be totally honest with you, it just boils down to climate. Mm-hmm. That's literally all it is. Like, I wish there was a complex reason for it, but it really just based off climate. Mm-hmm. All of these places have different climates. If you're in Dubai, you're in a desert, arid climate. If you're in Detroit, you're in a temperate climate, which means you have both hot and cold. If you're in LA, you're in an arid climate. If you're in Miami, you're in a humid climate. Mm-hmm. If you're in New Orleans, you're in a humid climate. Mm-hmm. So what that means is the building materials you use are going to be different because certain buildings absorb more heat. Certain ones release more heat. If you're in a place like Miami, you don't want to build with things that's going to absorb a lot of heat because it's always hot.
Yeah.
And unlike Los Angeles, which is an arid climate, at nighttime, the temperature drops.
Right.
When the temperature drops because you're in the desert, you need something that stored the heat from the morning and then releases it in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. If you have earthquakes versus hurricanes, also dictates how stuff can be built. So it really just predicated on climate, right? Like if you're in Chicago and Detroit, it gets cold as hell during the wintertime. Mm-hmm. So you're going to use heavier materials like masonry, bricks, et cetera, because that's what you need in order to do it. But you can do stick frame, meaning you can do wood frame construction on the inside. Mm-hmm. You're in a place like Miami where you have hurricanes, stick frame ain't enough. New Orleans, where there's hurricanes, stick frame ain't enough. Those houses get blown away all the time.
Right.
Right. Then we think about Miami. I mean, we think about Los Angeles, which has hurricanes. So you can do stick frame. understanding that the ground is going to be slightly unsettled at a different moment. So
yeah.
Each of these places that have architects wrote the dam, designed based off of the climate. Like, you do not design a house in Miami like you would in Chicago, because the conditions are not the same. And because the conditions are not the same, you should design as such.
I learned something new. Have you done any research on alternatives to gentrification or less destructive forms of rebuilding or whatever?
So that's not really, so hate to be the bearer of bad news, but unless there's a massive amount of reparations that happens around the country, we got to stop viewing gentrification as like this boogeyman.
Yeah.
Because it's like, at the end of the day, if you want to buy a house, you got to go somewhere where the house is affordable. And how are you going to get mad at Deborah, who wants to buy a single family home because she's finally set up the money to do it, and the only neighborhood she can do it is a neighborhood that she's not from that's poor? Because your race don't mean nothing. You still a gentry. Like, you're still a gentrifier. So, like, it's purely an economic thing. The issue comes in, this is just my opinion, but the issue comes in where people try to displace culture. That, in my opinion, is the big issue. If a white family moves into an all-black neighborhood and understand that the neighborhood they're moving into has parties at nighttime, or it can get loud when there's barbecues, or people sitting on the front porch, or people barbecue in their backyard, and they don't want to call the police on them, then move on in. Then black people are going to embrace you.
Right.
The problem is that white family typically moves to a place because they're seduced by the culture. And then when they get there, want to change it to their culture. Like, oh my God, I love New Orleans. I love the music. I love the sounds. Move there. Oh my God, it's so loud. I want to go to bed. I'm going to call the cops.
Yeah.
It's like, what are you doing? Like, this is the culture that made you want to come here. This is the culture that enticed you. Why are you trying to erase that? So I try to tell people it's way more nuanced than that. Now, if you want to, if you want to get mad at a developer or a private company who comes in with a predatory thought process to buy up tons of low income property to then flip it, absolutely. The absolute gentrification. Those people are the worst scum of the earth.
Yeah.
Get rid of them. Take them out to the firing range. Let them get dealt with. Like, hate those types of people whatsoever.
Yeah.
But the rank and file person who just wants to better their own life, like, I can't get mad at that person regardless of their race. I just can't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not fair to them. Like, they're not the ones that prop up these capitalist systems. They're just a product of it. So they want to find a place to live that's safe for their family with good schools for their kids. Like, it is what it is. Just don't be the feds. Like, don't move into a neighborhood and want to call the police. Like, that's when you whack.
Don't
do that.
And
that's always the first thing they do. Like, if they didn't do that, you wouldn't have half these issues, man. People be like, oh yeah, man, we know Ryder and Willow that live next door. Like, we know them. They're awesome. They're great neighbors. But they ain't calling the police. The problem is when your Karens and your Georges hear somebody outside and they want to call the cops, and it's like, bro, why did you just call the police?
Right.
That's like, to me, that's
because, you know, sometimes I can see is they don't see their neighbor as a human being, and the feeling of like approaching your neighbor and maybe asking them to turn down the music. Like, I recently watched the clip of Hustle and Flow where they're like creating a song, and he go to the dude next door like, all right, can you just for 15 minutes like turn down the music? And so and then, exactly what you said in New Orleans was happening. And even so much so that, you know, they move to the French Quarter and then get sound ordinances passed.
Yep.
And it's like,
they the feds.
You could have moved anywhere else.
They the feds. Like, in that regard, they the feds. Like, damn, like, you the worst. You the absolute worst.
Yeah, and then, the DMV area with the go-go music. And then, you know, I read an article about New York City where, you know, the Dominicans and the older black men playing, like, chess on the sidewalk. Like,
they're colonizers. Right. Like, they come, like, you can tell certain things are hereditary. Clearly, colonization is hereditary. These people, like, they five generations removed from the British who came in and take over America, but they still doing the same things. The first time you move to somebody's neighborhood, I have to teach you the white way.
Right.
Please, I'm going to teach you. You don't sit on the front porch and play cards.
Right.
You don't have the music blasting after 7 p.m. Like, that's the white way. That ain't the neighborhood you moved into, bro. Like, go take that shit to the suburbs. That's what you want to do.
Right. So you have talked about struggling with how much of yourself and our culture do you want to give to the world, which more than anything comes from some white people's inability to just appreciate things, which in America, because of this melting pot concept, where since they're not often attached to their ancestral cultures, which they actually have access to, they're steeped in Americanness and whiteness, which leaves nothing really. So some people take whatever tickles their fancy without any thought to what it means to the people they're taking it from. So how do you balance the thin line between access and denial?
I don't explain anything. Mm-hmm. It's 100%. If you know, you know.
Right.
Dead ass. Like, it's that simple. Like, I design this stuff and the people that know, they get it. The people that don't ask me questions and I say, take your own artistic license. Yeah. Like, I do it just like that. Like, that's how I gatekeep. And then the very like intimate stuff, I just don't even put that out in the world. I don't even give people the chance to interpret it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't mind taking a hair comb and turning it into a chair, because like everybody knows that iconography.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm not going to reveal secrets. Like, I'm not going in the background saying like, this is what we really mean when we say these words behind y'all back, or this is what this handshake really means, or this is like, I ain't saying none of that. Like,
yeah,
that kind of stuff will never make it into the zeitgeist. Right. The rest of it though, like, I don't care, but I'm just not going to explain it. I'm going to make this spice rack, but I'm not going to explain to you the significance of Lowry's. Either you get it or you don't. Like, I'm not going to explain to you the significance of hot sauce. Like, you get it or you don't. Like, it is what it is.
That's what's annoying to me about TikTok, is everybody explaining stuff. Like, I don't shut up. TikTok.
I don't have it.
A lot of young people are like out there like explaining our slang and all that stuff. And they're like, why? Like, if the point, I'm in a space of acknowledging AAVE/Ebonic/slang or whatever, and knowing that it came out of the necessity of, like, they didn't allow us to read. There was a lot of African languages that were commingling together. A lot of AAVE still has the grammar structure of a lot of African languages. Yeah. Like it's not ignorant, it's a dialect. And so also it was created to not be understood by, like, the slave. Like, we could talk about different things, certain aspects of the language. We could talk about maybe escaping or something right in front of their face, but they wouldn't know what we were talking about. So, like, why are you explaining this to people? that is just an annoying aspect of social media right now for me.
But you gotta see it from the other side too, though. Like, a lot of these Gen Z kids, because that's who on TikTok. Yeah. A lot of these Gen Z kids' parents are Generation X. And those Generation X people have worked really hard to make it so that they Gen Z kids have an easier life.
Yeah.
But when you grow up with an easier life, you don't gatekeep as much. You don't gatekeep as much, because you see these white people as your friend, these Latinos as your friend, these Asians as your friend. You all in the same privileged situation.
Yeah.
Whereas your parents were not in that situation. They were not seen as the same. They were seen as other. And so always, like, I can't get mad at these kids that are just doing the stuff that their parents work hard for. I can get mad at the parents for not instilling some sort of cultural importance.
Yeah.
But that's on the parents. Like, these kids' parents should be saying, don't give those secrets away. Mm-hmm. If they're not even doing that because they don't care, then what am I going to get mad at the kids for?
Yeah. And then to go back to, you know, speaking of parents and then the colonization and appropriation, it's gotten to a point on TikTok where white parents are calling out black people for talking TikTok slang or Gen Z slang, because that's where they take it from. But it's like, we've been talking about like this for decades. Yeah, yeah. So their lack of their ignorance is having them call out, oh, why are you talking like young people? Like, we're talking like black people. Y'all took our language.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. You see it on Twitter. You can easily tell who's a white person pretending to be a black person on Twitter versus an actual black person on Twitter. It's like, bro, we do not.
It's
like
so
that.
Easy.
It's the same words, but you are not using them in the right sentence. That's not right syntax, not right order or nothing. I don't know what you're talking about.
And that's because even in AAVE, they don't realize that there's a grammar structure. Like, we can tell when you're speaking it incorrectly. What is the power of vulnerability in your work?
I don't think there's any vulnerability in the design objects. I think there's vulnerability in the process. Like, I meet with communities, I talk with communities, and that takes a lot of vulnerability, because oftentimes the communities are black communities and they've been overpromised and underdelivered. So I have to be vulnerable to build trust.
Yeah.
So in that regard, there's vulnerability, but not in the actual designs and stuff. Again, it goes back to the gatekeeping.
Yeah. Yeah. So using the idea of creating a new column order derived from Blackness, what can you say is the importance of us pushing forward the history of our existence in these spaces that have been ignored and adding to the future of these spaces with our current cultures?
I call that an expansion of the canon. Mm-hmm. So like the canon is all the historical buildings, peoples, places that we use as foundation when we craft future architects, designers, musicians, animators, etc. It's like mm-hmm. these are the foundational people who created the discipline. You have to know this stuff.
Yeah.
Unless you're Black or unless mm-hmm. you're Caribbean or mm-hmm. unless you're Southeast Asian, because yeah. like Korea, China, Japan, they're represented. But you're from Indonesia or India, you're not that represented, right? So
mm-hmm.
For me, it's about bringing awareness to the second largest continent in the entire globe that mm-hmm. is often completely missing from architectural history classes, survey courses, precedent studies. And so you go through 4 years, 6 years, 3 years of architectural education and never see a Black architect or never see a Black building by an architect or whatever. And you're just like, how is this possible when we have an entire continent that clearly has architecture?
Yeah.
Why is this not in my curriculum? Why is the only thing I'm looking at is stuff from Eurocentric places or Western culture? Like, I'm tired of seeing these same buildings from Corbusier or from Rem Koolhaas. Like, can I see something from Francis Curie or something like that? So that's what I like to do.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate thing is a lot of times this stuff is not in architecture. It's in other disciplines. It's in archaeology. It's in anthropology because they've done the research. And then we have to then decipher that as architects and then bring it in to a spatial lens to then disseminate it to our students. And so that's the hardest part is like, how many books on archaeology do I have to read to find these architectural influences in classical architecture? Oh, I gotta read 13. Awesome. Now let's go read 13 books so I can get this stuff in here to put it as part of my curriculum so the next wave of students aren't devoid of the same authors that I was devoid of.
Right. So I've, let's see. I've simultaneously been doing the work to not live in proximity to whiteness in my personal life and also advocating for the idea of Black American culture being a viable culture. It's understandable that as Black Americans, we try to learn our roots, but sometimes we do that in place of, instead of in addition to cementing the uplifting of a culture that inspires even the continent. So through your work, with the various aspects of Black American culture and its relations to architecture, what have you maybe discovered about the strength of our culture?
I'm going to take you saying our culture to mean U.S. Black culture.
Yes.
Because I can't speak for other cultures.
Right.
Because I'm not of those cultures.
That's what I meant.
But I think for me, architecturally, it's been very illuminating to learn of like Black vernacular architecture and sort of the history of where the shotgun home comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Something that is one of the most key defining architectural inventions of the last 100, 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's distinctly Black. So that's pretty dope. And then we see porches all over the place. And that's another thing that's derived from West Africa. So again, undeniably Black.
Yeah.
So in that regard, I think that's our extremely important cultural influences mm-hmm. through architecture. I think other stuff outside of that are rituals, and like rituals are shared across various ethnicities. Like there's stuff that we do that Cubans do,
mm-hmm.
that Puerto Ricans do that isn't necessarily different. It's basically the same, but we just might have a different seasoning on it, so to speak.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's how I would categorize it.
When I was listening to one of your talks, I thought it was interesting where you brought up the point of because of like multiple families living in a space, that's what became the importance of the porch because it was the mm-hmm. extension of your living space and you just couldn't do it inside.
Mm-hmm. It really like almost all the stuff that Black people do is not because you want to. You ain't got no choice.
You're right.
Like, y'all gave us one bedroom. So now we got to go in the porch because we ain't got enough space. So then
right.
it becomes important. Or you give us the crappy parts of the pig, so now we eat chitlins.
Mm-hmm.
Or you give us the crappy parts of the cow, and now we eat oxtail.
Yeah.
Like, it's literally just a matter of survival, like all of it. And then we just make it cool because we cool as hell. Like, that's how it works. It's like, Nah, bro, this was not supposed to happen. I would much rather have a very blissful and chill-free life where I ain't got to do nothing. Like, you think I want to have to make oxtail? I'd rather not have to invent them. I'd rather be able to just eat the fucking 12-ounce porterhouse instead. Because that's what y'all get to do.
Yeah.
I had to make the oxtail because that's all y'all left me.
Right.
So in that regard, like, give me the former.
Yeah.
Like, nobody, I don't nobody want to struggle. Like, nobody. Like, if you tell me I got to choose struggle and being cool over not struggling and being a lame, give me lame every day of the week. Like, nobody trying to think about getting shot or like wearing my hat a certain way because I'm gonna have to fight when I get home. I ain't trying to do that shit.
Yeah. Even I learned recently, like maybe last year, that, you know, the context to why we eat, you know, meat well done, because they gave us crappy meat. So we made it well done just to make sure we don't die. Like,
yeah, yeah, all the time. But then, but at that certain point that you get older now, you're like, all right, fam, like, all
right, like
stop getting the well done now.
Because we don't know the context, we don't know, okay, like, now we can do a little paint.
Like, you chew on for 30 days, bro. Like, don't ever give me that meat.
All right. So you were part of a team that delivered a presentation that talked about vigilantism and white hegemony, mm-hmm. where you talk about how architectural structures, in addition to people, can contribute to, you know, the white dominance, which the concept can be expanded to, which I feel white supremacist structures, vigilantism in the workplace, and how both can prevent diversity and make marginalized groups feel uncomfortable in many spaces, even when there are diversity efforts. So can you talk about how architectural structures can contribute to white hegemony and vigilantism?
So I guess, so that's something where it's not necessarily the structures per se, but the social structures that exist.
Yeah.
When I say not the structures, I mean not the architectural structures, like not the tectonics. It's not the brick and mortar. It's not the gypsum board. It's not the wood studs. Mm-hmm. It's the social structures that exist within those. Vigilantism essentially is people deputizing themselves to be an authority, even though they're not proper authorities. And so we see it in the workplace all the time. It's the person who tells you, you 5 minutes late. It's like, bro, you're not my boss. Why are you worried about that? But then what about that space makes the people think they have that authority?
Right.
Or what about owning the key fob makes you think you're the security guard to allow somebody in and out of a building because they forgot their key fob or don't have one, right? And so there's like the architecture of authority, and then there's like the social aspects of authority. And so where they collide is where I'm most interested. It's like, what made you think, because you go to this park all the time, that the black family can't barbecue there? Like, who deputized you, Batman? like, chill out, bro. Like, you really need to calm down. Like, you care way too much. And then people try to disguise it as, well, I'm caring about my neighborhood. I want to preserve my neighborhood. What about it do you want to preserve? What about it do you think is homogenous? That's what it is. Like, people want homogeny. They don't like heterogeneity. Because if it's hetero, then it gets to be different.
Yeah.
If it's homogenous, then it's all consistent. It's all the same. That's just not the way people want to, like, people want that. Which is always weird, because the people who scream for homogeny in the built environment are the same people that are probably homophobic. Like, it's a weird dynamic. Like, you want your neighborhood to be homogenous, but you do not embrace homosexuality. Like, you realize how insane and contradictory that is.
Yep.
But they're weird people. So, you know, it is what it is.
So my last question, if someone's producing a documentary about you, what things would you want them to highlight about your life outside of your work in architecture and, you know, that space?
If somebody did a documentary on me, people would not believe it. I lived a crazy ass life. I can honestly say that. Like, it is insane. What would I want them to make sure they include? I would make sure that they include that. Trying to say what I can say without revealing too much. I would want them to know what it means to grow up on the west side of Chicago and how that influences a person's career.
Yeah.
It's one thing to, and I try to explain this to people. Like, I know I stopped myself mid-sentence, but there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
I try to explain to people, it's a difference between growing up in the hood and growing up poor. Mm-hmm. They're not the same thing. They're not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can do both. You can grow up in the hood and be poor.
Right.
But they're not the same. You can grow up in the hood and have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm someone that grew up in the hood and grew up upper middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And people feel like they can't wrap their head around that. They're like, what? Why didn't y'all move? Why didn't you live in the suburbs? Because nobody wants to be the one black family on the block. Nobody wants to be the one that can't go in the backyard and barbecue because all the white neighbors gonna look at you crazy. Like, anybody trying to deal with that pressure?
Right.
So instead, you just stay in the hood. And so, like, when you in your house, you in a bubble. When you go outside of your house, you might have to fight on your way home from the bus stop.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody asks you, what's your shoe size? You better say my size. And either be prepared to run or be prepared to fight.
Right.
And so all those things influence the way that I design stuff and the way that I practice and the way that I engage with people. And that's the kind of stuff you cannot learn in school. You cannot learn in academia. It cannot be reproduced through a book. Like, that's learned and lived experiences. And so like that's what I would make sure that they keep in the documentary.
Yeah, my dad has a PhD and he's like, I'll take my hood smarts over my education every day.
Oh, all day. Like, I use my street smarts probably infinitely more than I use my book smarts on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the hood taught me how to be charming, not school. Because you better be ready to finesse yourself out of situation or know when you're being finessed.
Right.
Or you better know that's how you talk to somebody you're interested in. Like,
right.
She got five dudes trying to holler at her. What's going to make you different? You better have some sort of game to make yourself get out of that. So when you go into a classroom, it's easy to talk to students. If you go in front of a microphone to talk to an audience, it's easy to keep them captivated. Like, you know how much harder this is when you one-on-one with a girl you like?
Right.
Like, that's way harder than this. This is easy. Right.
One of my favorite quotes, like, because my dad would let me go in his class, like, the first day, because, you know, I look 15 years younger than I actually am. And so, like, some of his students still think I'm in high school or college or something like that. But one of my favorite things he would say was like, okay, I have a BS degree. That means I can talk bullshit. I have an MS degree. That means I can talk more shit. And I have a PhD, which means my shit is piled high and deep. So there's nothing you can get over on me.
Absolutely. That's the way it works, man. It's real.
But also for you to talk about, you know, growing upper middle class in the hood, I feel like in so many spaces, Black people have to attach the struggle or being poor to being Black, where even if you compare like a Cosby show to the Good Times, people are like, oh, Good Times is actually being Black and not in the Cosby show. It's not. And it's like, both are being Black.
Yep.
You might identify more with the Good Times, but they both exist and can't coexist.
Absolutely.
All right. So I want to thank you for allowing me to highlight you on my platform. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And if anybody wants to follow you in your work, where can they do that?
Instagram at gmane16, GMANE16, or on Twitter. Well, I don't really tweet that much. Every now and then I retweet a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Uncle Remus Chicken, Uncle Remus CHKN. It's it's a double pun. I'll let people figure out what it means, but that's the Twitter handle.
All right, and to everyone out there, I want you to like so I know it's real. Comment and tell me how you feel. Subscribe to Seal the Deal and sign up for post notifications to show your zeal. And I'll see you in the next video. Peace.